Hello and welcome to another episode of Dice Exploder. Each week we take one RPG mechanic and give it a reupholster. My name is Sam Dunnewald and my co-host today is Caro Murphy. Caro is best known as one of the designers behind Galactic Star Cruiser, the big Star Wars hotel experience from a couple of years ago that got a lot of attention, but they've designed a lot more experiences than just the one famous Star Wars thing, and they have a long and storied history with big-ass LARPs. And here, very close to the end of the LARP series I've been doing on this show, I wanted to have them on to talk about experience design. What is experience design? Even after this interview, I'm not sure I have a definition that's more useful than the design of everything in an experience. Something so broad as to be pretty useless, at least for me. But I feel like in comparing LARP to tabletop games, there's a lot of overlap, right? You're doing a lot of role-playing, inventing fiction together, stepping inside of it. But a certain kind of LARP has this physicality to it, production values, this idea that you're going to build out the whole fictional world with sets and props and costumes. Not just the embodiment stuff I talked about with Kate Hill 10 episodes ago, but more than that, like production around the edges. And that's what I wanted to talk to Caro about, as someone with a lot of experience there. How do you design those things? And we did talk about that, but also way, way more, like bleed and empathy and games as an inherently educational medium. Caro has just got so much to share and a lot that us indie TTRPG designers can learn from. So with that, thank you to everyone who supports this show on Patreon. And here is Caro Murphy with experience design. Caro Murphy, thanks so much for coming on Dice Exploder.
Thanks so much for having me, Sam.
Yeah, I'm so used to coming into an episode like, this is the very hardcore specific example game mechanic that we're going to talk about. Mm-hmm. And this episode is going to be a little bit broader. And so as part of that, I really wanted to set up who you are and what your background is like. So who are you? What's your background like?
Yeah, I kind of cycle between calling myself a game designer, experience designer, LARP designer. It depends on mm-hmm. the crowd that I'm with, to be honest. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I make experiences that are meant to be played by an audience, really, like people who are not normally necessarily jumping into the actor's seat, but I do a lot of that. So I have been doing LARP design for more than 20 years and then moved into the world of interactive and immersive theater. The most notable project that I worked on was Star Wars Galactic Star Cruiser. So that's what everybody knows me from, is that yeah. particular body of work. But I do so many other things as well. So, yeah.
I remember you from old episodes of Imaginary Worlds.
Yeah, where I converted Eric into a LARPer.
Yeah, I'll have to put those in the show notes because they're also a good introduction to what the heck is LARP sort of media.
Yeah, and Sam, you're on your LARP conversion path already, so.
I am. I mean, like, I feel like I'm far down my LARP conversion path.
Incredible.
I LARPed for the first time in 2018, and I've been trying to do it more and more since, but it's, you know, one of the things that I find daunting about LARP and especially the kinds of experiences that you're making is organizing it. I mean, people mm-hmm. complain about organizing in tabletop games when they're just trying to get four friends together, and trying to get 15 people into one room can be difficult. So
yeah.
I also wanted to start out with, like, okay, what are you really excited about right now, like in your work? Like, what feels new and on the frontier for you?
I think that for me, I'm really interested in the sort of space where LARP and spiritual practice intersect.
Ooh.
So that's something that I'm really focused on right now. So I'm working to design some games with a Zen priest, mm-hmm. and we're working on designing LARPs for embodying precepts. So mm-hmm. if anybody's familiar with Buddhism and the Buddhist precepts, then I'm designing LARPs for that. Because
can you go into like more detail of example of like what that looks like?
Yeah. So one of the things that when people kind of are learning about Zen, they learn about the precepts. And precepts are sort of ideas about the way that Dharma or our sort of true nature comes forward as we kind of study and progress more in our spiritual paths. And it's not like rules or commandments. It's more like these are things that kind of naturally emerge when you're doing this. So like one of the things is like not killing, right? So in the LARP, you would explore the exact opposite of that.
Right? Oh, all right.
So the LARP is there to like confront you with the fact that you are human and that you contain multitudes, like that yeah. you contain both all the things that make you light and great and beautiful. You contain equal amounts of darkness, right? So these are important things for us to be able to hold and integrate, because if we ignore them, then they come out in ugly, nasty ways. So important for your spiritual development to confront the killer within you and the thief within you and things like that.
Yeah, cool. So you recommended we maybe start with this like taxonomy of experiences graph that you sent me. And I think this thing is really cool. It's this chart. There'll be a link that people should pull up, because now we're going to spend 90 seconds trying to explain a chart that is complicated.
And it's a 3D chart too. So
yes, but I would love to hear you do your best effort here to explain what this thing looks like so we can talk about it a little
bit. So when I think about like lots of experiences that fall within sort of this category that we think of as immersive, that like, we have sort of basically a marketing term that's saying this thing is immersive. And what that means to people is
to be clear, you're doing massive air quotes around
air quotes,
immersive.
Yeah. Thank you. But what does that mean, right? So I tried to sort of break it down by, if we look at these different things from slightly different perspectives, then what do we end up with in terms of different sort of categories of experience?
Yeah.
So on one axis, you have the agency of the participants, like how much actual say the participants have over what is happening within the world that they are experiencing, right? So do the actions that you take have consequences? And that those don't necessarily need to be supported by any sort of mechanic, right? Like taking an action could still just be having a conversation, but how somebody responds to that conversation within the context of the story and whether or not the narrative changes based on that is an important part of agency. Then you have on another axis, you have basically how like actually physically immersive the world is, like your set and your setting. This is not to say that there is like a hierarchy of that. You can absolutely do a black box game and it can be absolutely astoundingly wonderful and immersive in so many ways.
And what does a black box game mean?
Oh, black box, like as in like black box theater. So literally like the room is all black walls and you don't have any props or costumes or anything like that. You just have your imagination and this sort of blank space to act things out in. And then on the other axis, you have sort of like mechanics. So what are the interaction mechanics? Like, are there like game systems or rules systems that are in place that help people understand how to interact with the world? So, for example, there are immersive theater pieces that have no game mechanics whatsoever, but you might have a high degree of agency because of how you talk to the actors in the experience, and that might change the flow of things. Murder mystery dinner parties and things like this, right? There's not maybe not many mechanics outside of sort of like contingency envelopes or contingency happenings, little if-then statements kind of thing. But other than like sort of narrative flow mechanics, you're probably not going to have like a lot in there. Versus something like an escape room where you have lots of crunchy mechanics, right? You need to solve a series of gates and puzzles and tasks and activities in order to sort of get to the next stage.
Yeah, and I feel like the escape room comparison is so interesting because it's like high agency, often highly immersive. Like I remember doing an escape room where I really did feel like I was in a haunted house, right? And like you said, there's a lot of mechanics. And also, not really much story, you know, like in a way, like so much of the media we're talking about here are traditionally like storytelling mediums, that escape rooms is this interesting sort of addition to the conversation.
Well, interestingly, there's a big trend in escape rooms right now where they're really going in a very narrative direction. More and more escape rooms have started incorporating live actors. They've started having much more robust narratives. The narrative setup and completion of the narrative for the participants is much more and more of a focus for escape room creators. So we're seeing in this like fourth gen escape room wave, like lots of very exciting things that I'm delighted to see.
Yeah, it does kind of feel like there's a lot of different media that have been evolving towards a similar thing that you are working in, right? Like you've got this escape room thing, but you also have the LARP tradition and you also have Sleep No More coming out of theater. And it's cool to see different people arriving at a similar place.
Absolutely. It's cool. And to me, it speaks to something so fundamental about our different art forms, which is that these are really mediums for us to connect. And I think that's so beautiful. Like this longing for connection that brings us all together. Like what a cool, magical thing.
Yeah. So I'm curious to maybe start from tabletop RPGs, because I think that's sort of the like foundational perspective of my audience here.
Sure.
Like, what really changes in your heart as you are doing like a LARP or doing an escape room or doing some other sort of immersive quote unquote experience compared to tabletop RPGs? Like, how does the, I think of like embodying actual characters in LARP being a big part of this, but the way you put it also in an email we had was like, in tabletop RPGs, mechanics are often representative of action, but in live experiences, action represents action.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious to hear you talk about like what that fundamentally does to the experience of someone participating.
Well, I think one of the things that's very interesting about it is that since it is acted out physically, that you have this other layer of immersion where you are now sort of joining the physical space because your body is involved in this way where you're no longer really able to just puppet your character. You're inside of your character. You have to be like moving this character around. So there's this really interesting theory of immersion that was first sort of coined by Moira Turkington that has to do with sort of like the separation in layers between the role player and their character. Mm-hmm. So at the first sort of stage of immersion, they call it like the marionette stage, where the character is pretty far from you, right? You're pulling its strings, but you feel pretty separate and pretty apart from the character. Then you have the puppet stage, and this is like a Jim Henson puppet, where you've got your hand inside the puppet kind of thing, and now you're a little bit more embodied in the character. You're moving the character around a little more. Then there's the mask stage, where the character sort of like, you're wearing the character as a mask, but it's a costume that you're wearing, and you're actually physically embodying the character pretty strongly. And then the last stage is possessing force, where you and the character sort of dissolve, and the character has this autonomy of their own that takes over, and you become this observer that can do a little directing of what your character's doing, but you're not playing a role anymore. It's very lived. It's very real.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I feel like my experience of tabletop games and of LARP sees me sliding between those throughout play.
Ooh, tell me about that.
Well, I mean, like, I can think of, like, last night I was playing Yaziva's Bed and Breakfast, which is this game with a bunch of pre-established characters that you're sort of picking up like you are actors in a play, right? Pre-gens. I did a whole episode on this. Go listen to it.
Cool.
But so I remember picking up a character and being very much at that marionette stage to begin with of like, I'm getting the feel for who this person is. I've been given this premise of like what they're doing and who they're talking to and what's going on. And I'm kind of over here watching it and sort of thinking about like, okay, how can I poke and prod at the character to get them to do to get the fiction to do the thing that I think would be interesting for it to do.
Yeah.
And then as we played 45 minutes later, I'm like in the middle of a scene. Someone else says a thing that happens. I get hit in the face with a pancake. And I like remember seeing this happen like I was watching a cartoon and suddenly being overwhelmed with the like emotional feeling of my character, like seeing what she or like feeling what she responded to in that moment feeling much more, you know, like all the way to mask or something.
Absolutely.
Right. And in LARP also, like I've definitely had experiences, I think in LARP with embodiment, you start, or I at least start much further along this track for exactly the reasons that we're talking about. But I also have had the experience of being like, I'm exhausted. I need a break. I'm getting some water and I'm back to being Sam for a minute. Like,
totally.
And then, you know, someone comes and talks to you while you're getting water and it's like, not now, man. I'm not in the, like, you know, like, so I don't know. I don't know. Yeah.
Absolutely. I think it's really interesting because for some people, there can be such a powerful transformational aspect of sort of taking on a role. And I think that tabletop and LARP both do this. I think we discover things about ourselves. We have these like hidden talents and like locked away secrets that like the secret is that you are infinite, right? And that you have so access to so many personalities and perspectives and ideas and things like that. But we sort of lock those things away. And I think that the beautiful thing about role playing is it dissolves that in this like sort of bath of play where you don't even realize that you're learning new skills, but then you do.
Yeah. Yeah. Something else I'm thinking about here, I was listening to my other friend's podcast recently, RTFM, which did an episode where they were talking about scene-based games. And one of the hosts, Max Lander, was talking about how they feel really uncomfortable with scene-based games because they don't like to sort of embody a character that way. They would much rather sit back and sort of observe and, you know, maybe do a dungeon crawly kind of thing or whatever. Mm-hmm. But that also they're really interested in getting into LARP and like are really like excited about that idea. And that I don't know. I've been trying to think about like what's the disconnect there. Like something about maybe embodiment maybe gives you more alibi to like just be yourself and like have other people assume that you're pretending to be someone else. Whereas like at a table, when you are playing in a third person tabletop game, you are much more explicitly like showing the difference between your character and yourself.
Yeah.
And
well, I think that so much of both of these worlds also has to do with like who's around the table with you.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
totally.
Like, these are relationship-based forms. Like, these are all dialogic. Like, if you're role-playing, then even if you're role-playing with yourself, you're still having a dialogue. You know,
Yeah.
Like, the art form is inherently relationship-based. So I think that who you play with is going to shape your experience immensely. Like, if you're around mm-hmm. the table with a bunch of people who are all, like, hey, we're just kind of here to, like, roll some dice and eat pizza and, like laugh and have a good time, then you might have a totally different experience. And it might be a great experience, but it might just be like a little more casual than this like deep embodied, like emotional, you know. Same thing with LARP. Like there are absolutely LARPs where it's just kind of like hanging out in the woods with your friends, smacking each other with a weapon. And like that's totally cool. You know, like there's room for all of the different types of experiences that people want to have with it.
Totally. Okay, we've talked about immersion a couple of times, and every time we've had to put scare quotes around the term. So I want to talk about the scare quotes. Like, I understand that the idea of immersion is, I think, maybe a loaded conversation in the world of LARP. But I'm curious to hear you talk about, like, what do you mean by immersion, and what do you think are, like, the pros and cons of it if we're taking the scare quotes away?
Yeah, I was just having this conversation with a friend of mine where she was asking me, like, what does immersion mean to you? And that was really the first time that I had thought about it, because I was like, well, you know, it's like a feeling.
Yeah.
It's a feeling that you get. And
it's when you go and you're immersed, right?
Like, right. And I think that that's true. I think that immersion is a feeling, and we know when we're immersed and we know when we're not immersed, but I don't know that it has like a really great, robust definition. Hmm. And I think that that's kind of a beautiful, mysterious thing that I don't want to unpack. Like,
that's fair.
It's like, I think it's beautiful for it to live in that space of like, well, you feel it.
Can I maybe ask you this way then? Can you tell me about a time when you felt very immersed and what that moment was like for you?
Sure. So I think the first time I ever experienced the possessing force level of immersion, I was running a LARP campaign. This was New York City. This was like 20 years ago. And one of the players took an action that I totally wasn't expecting. I was playing her NPC sister, and she took an action where she took her father's soul and like released it from this container that it was in. And her father was this evil guy. And I was then like, the sister was possessed by the father. And I don't really remember what happened. I was kind of a passenger watching what happened. But this intense, incredible scene then took place between her and like a bunch of other onlookers who were seeing all this going down. And it was just epic. Like, it was just this spine tingling, like everybody was lost in the moment. Everybody was completely bought into what was happening. It just was super high stakes and felt really, really real.
Yeah. I feel like I've had that experience, and I love that experience.
Yeah.
And also, that experience, I think, comes with...
Bleed.
Bleed, certainly.
Yeah.
So maybe tell me about Bleed. Like, what is Bleed? Let's start there.
So Bleed is a term for when the feelings of a character become real for you, the player. Now, this can be extraordinarily positive. It can also be extraordinarily negative. So yeah. What we want to aim for in role-playing is a positive bleed, and we want to try to mitigate or minimize negative bleed, or at least control the circumstances around our negative bleed so that mm-hmm. we are understanding what risk levels we are putting ourselves into.
Yeah. Yeah. And so what I heard from you talking about your experience of immersion there was a lot of bleed, I think. I mean, I think of bleed in some 100%. Ways as sort of being something that people talk about sort of post facto. I was as like, you live with bleed, like after the thing has happened. But like, I won't make you define immersion this way. But to me, maybe like immersion is when the bleed is happening like one-to-one, like in the moment, it's like really dialed up and it is happening right now. And yeah, I don't know. I guess I'm curious at like how I wanted to ask about pros and cons, but the pros seem self-evident, right? It's like that mm-hmm. feeling is really cool if
yeah.
you like that feeling.
Right. And your brain is learning something. Like,
yeah.
truly, like, that's real.
Well, so what do you mean by learning something? Like, what do you think you're learning?
Like, our brains don't know the difference between the direct experiences that we have in a simulated environment and in a real environment. Mm-hmm. So if that feeling is real for your character, it is real, period. Like, you're really having that experience. And I believe that all experiences are teachers for us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is something that I believe, but it sounds like you're saying games and these kinds of experiences intentionally can be, like, learning experiences for, I mean, all kinds of fucking things,
so
right?
Like, many things. Absolutely. Yeah. Yes, I completely agree. I think that, like, the space of play is sort of intrinsically educational. Like, mm-hmm. I think that you can use a playful space in order to learn anything that you want to learn. I know that I have. Like, I've made characters who were car mechanics because I wanted to learn how to fix my car.
Oh,
and I
wow.
didn't have the motivation to do it myself. So I made a character who did, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And, like, I truly think that that works for a lot of people. Like,
yeah.
Yes, I'm a huge believer in the connection between education and sort of this space of non-deterministic outcomes where we get to play.
Yeah, that's so interesting you talk about learning to be a mechanic, because I think of it so much for me as, like, I love these kinds of games as practicing emotional experiences, right? Practicing
oh, yeah.
grief or practicing
yeah,
friendship or, you know, humility or whatever. And I think, like, American society, at least, is pretty bad at giving people spaces to practice those feelings.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And it's cool to think that you also could just, like, yeah, practice how to peel potatoes or whatever. Like,
yeah,
totally you can.
Megan Gardner is like a LARP education designer, and she has developed LARP educational curriculum to teach STEM to mm-hmm. middle schoolers with LARP. And it works. You know, it works really well.
That's cool. Like, what are those games like?
It depends on the game, but I can send you to her website. But if you look up yeah. Guard Up Adventures, like, that's a bunch of her work.
Well, I'll put a link in the episode description.
Your next favorite game is on My First Dungeon.
Hello and welcome to My First Dungeon.
Hello and welcome to My First Dungeon.
Ho, 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 and welcome to My First Dungeon.
From Sad Space Cowboys,
Kamari takes out a lighter from their pocket and goes, this bar's next.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. Let's go.
To death metal Viking cats.
Hello Kitty, you see Melody Tuffington flying through the air, jacked as shit, massive legs, to horny snowmen?
The sad part is that Joshua never gave Frosty a penis.
No.
And everything in between.
It was a dark and stormy night.
We've got something for everyone.
You're a special Gertrude girl. In a special Gertrude role, happy birthday, happy birthday! I'm not a skeleton.
Learn the game, then hear it in action.
That's Snake Eyes minus two, that's a zero.
Snake Eyes, that means that we have our very first plot twist. Anytime somebody rolls doubles, we get a plot twist.
So grab some headphones
and get lost in a story with us.
I'll be honest, I don't know all the rules of it. We'll kind of figure that out as we go. But do you want to just play? I've got some great stories to tell you.
And remember,
if you're having fun, you're already doing it right.
Oh, fuck!
I feel like I've kind of been like laying some groundwork here for the like main thing that I do want to talk to you about is the sort of designing a immersive physical space. Mm-hmm. This feels like such a big and expansive thing that is, most people aren't going to get to do this.
Right. It feels intimidating, like, right?
It feels intimidating. And also, like, most people don't have access to a decommissioned battlecruiser to do a Battlestar Galactica LARP on, right? Like, there's a scale and a budget that I think you have worked at and not many people get to work at. And I'm just curious about the experience of working at that scale. Like, what are you thinking about? Like, what are the designable surfaces working at that scale? What components are you thinking about that scale that are just not even in consideration for other people?
Yeah, you would be surprised, like, really, like, how many of the skills that a tabletop designer has that translate to this scale. Like, where the leap is that instead of thinking about five player experiences or however many people are around your table, you're thinking about 30 player experiences or 100 player experiences or whatever it is, the scale of your production. But really, still, like, as game designers, our jobs first and foremost are to be advocates for our players' experiences. So thinking about that, and then some of the ways that this scales up is that you can start to kind of generalize certain types of player experiences, and then you are like, oh, okay, I can make tracks if somebody wants sort of like a story of ne'er-do-welliness and being like a scoundrel and things like that, cool, then we can put them in this sort of track. And if somebody wants to be a hero and like really like fight the good fight, we can put them in this sort of track. And if somebody really wants to like explore their darkness and be a villain, we can sort of put them in this track. So you start kind of thinking about your world setting and you start to kind of peel apart the layers of that. The difficult part then is intertwining them and braiding them all together. And the stakes, you have to think about stakes in a slightly different way because you can't just blow up your world because it's not going to physically work. So how are you going to make sure that your players do still have agency within that, that your different tracks are going to play nicely together and that you can sort of put a nice little bow on everything? And different people have different approaches to this. So it's a little bit more like designing for a narrative video game at that scale because you do need to script certain amounts of outcomes when you have an audience that big.
Yeah. So you're talking about like the big jump there being thinking about scale of participants. And it sounded like one of the ways that you were talking about approaching that is to basically just like chunk them out into smaller groups again on like different tracks. Is that like a fair description there? Or
Like so storylines, so like creating different storylines that people could participate with and like figuring out what the five act arc or whatever that is to get to the same ending at the same time is, so that you can kind of time things appropriately. Pacing is super, super important. Like in tabletop too, pacing is super important. But you know, thinking about those elements and how they're going to tie together.
Hearing you talk about all of that, you are like talking a lot about logistics, right? Of like, how do you coordinate this many people? How do you coordinate the pacing so that they end at about the same time? How do you it feels like there's a lot of logistics involved. And it does feel like, I'm thinking about the video game narratives thing that you were talking about.
It
does feel like one of the ways to handle all those logistics is to put people on rails more. Like, you're talking about tracks, and I think of like a lot of the smaller LARPs that I have played, you know, 12 person LARPs and a lot of tabletop RPGs, one of the selling points is open world. Like, we can go out and do whatever we want. Like, that's the thing about D&D that's cool relative to video games.
Absolutely.
And I'm curious if you, how you're thinking about that. Like, are you trying to preserve that? Or is it just a different medium at that point?
It totally depends on the story that you're telling, really. Like, so there's a huge difference between like a tabletop one shot and a tabletop campaign game. Same thing in LARP too, right? So in LARP, a one shot, like if you're trying to do what basically what Star Cruiser did and you have a one shot repeatable experience, you're definitely going to end up with much more like tightly woven narrative framework, and that structure needs to hold, right? Whereas with LARP, you can be very loose. Like if you have a campaign LARP, that's much more like a campaign tabletop game.
Yeah.
Cool.
But even their LARPs, you'll see them sort of like creating story structures around cultures and like certain things that it just, it's the natural tendency for us to sort of like create story frameworks that people then can get invested in. So even in those, you're going to basically have tracks of some kind.
Yeah. How big of a team are you working with of like designers and like people doing the logistics on something like, well, I wanted to get into this. I was asking my friend Jason Morningstar what I should ask you about. And he recommended I ask you about Club Drosselmeyer.
Yeah, sure. Club Drosselmeyer is not my design. I'm an actor in it and I do co-directing for it. So Club Drosselmeyer is a fantastic, amazing immersive theater piece that runs in the Boston area every year. Imagine an escape room and a LARP or an immersive theater piece had a baby. And it's very that. So there are interactive characters and lots of puzzles to solve. And the puzzles form like gates. And once you cross a certain threshold, then you like get a little bit more information. So there's like, there are solutions to Club Drosselmeyer. Mm. And there are different endings to the show based on what people solve or what the audience decides to do. Like, so there is a fairly high amount of audience agency for a playable theater piece. And it is so fun. It's also like 1941 Nutcracker, like swing time, like war era. It's just so fun.
Cool. I'm going to ask you like a bunch of the questions that I just asked you, but like again, with this as an example, maybe.
Sure.
Like I would love to hear about like how many guests are coming through the club in a night and how big is the sort of like design team, the logistics team, like the number of performers involved.
Yeah. So Club Drosselmeyer has like 150 capacity per night. Mm-hmm. And then the show runs usually like five or six runs, depending on the dates booked and everything like that. The design team is relatively small. So the design team is a couple of puzzle designers and the like show writer, show designer. I should mention who some of these people are because they're awesome. So Kellyanne Pletcher is, Club Drosselmeyer is her brain baby. Brian Pletcher is her husband. He does a bunch of puzzle designs as well as acting in the show. Mm-hmm. And Errol Ellemere also does some puzzle designs for that as well. So the design teams are relatively small. Hmm. When we start doing workshops with actors, then often actors will add a lot of like ideas and content and things like that. So there is almost invariably with a show like this, there's a workshopping process where things are going to get changed around. So like the game matrix itself will shift a little bit because people will also notice things that don't make sense. Actors will be like, what's my motivation here? Like, why am I doing this? Yeah, you know, and then you're going to sort of rewrite things and then find ways for things to shift in.
Yeah.
But you'd be surprised. Like, I design pieces like this on my own completely and do all the logistics for it. So once you've got the skill set, I think it's something that is pretty achievable on your own.
Yeah, cool. So like Club Drosselmeyer is like a whole club also, right? So did you say how many like actors, performers are kind of involved?
Oh, there's a cast of, I want to say like a dozen or so people in the cast. And then there are like acts, like dance acts and other performers that come in as well. And those dance acts, there's probably another like 20 or so people who are dancers who perform different routines, but they usually don't have a lot of knowledge of the game matrix or what's going on. And then there are a bunch of people who are sort of in waiter costumes. There's like one or two of them are sort of like the GMs and know everything that's going on and can do a lot of puzzle hinting. They're all trained in the puzzle hinting kind of aspects of it. So they're there to facilitate and make sure that people don't get totally stuck and frustrated.
Yeah. And from having researched it a little bit, it seems like Club Drosselmeyer has been like going for a while.
Yeah.
How often does it change? Did you kind of do that initial workshopping and then it got locked in and it's still the same thing? Does it get revised? Like,
so it runs on a 4-year cycle. So it's like 1939 through 1941 and then 1942 and then it resets.
Interesting.
So the designs change every single time. And the initial conception of the show was that based on what the audience did last year, that that was going to impact the way things happened for the following year, which is so fun and so cool.
that's wild. So you're like intentionally trying to appeal to essentially like campaign players, right? To like come back and like experience the next one also.
Yeah. And people who love escape rooms love Club Drosselmeyer because it's very, very scratches the puzzly itch while having all these like awesome interactive characters as well.
Yeah. And do the audience members like take on a character, or if I'm showing up, I'm like basically myself?
They are immediately cast in the role of people going to a club in 1941. Sure. You know, so
yeah.
Some of them will adopt that a persona and like immediately sort of like go into role play mode. And some people are like, oh, okay, cool, great, and like, you know, they're themselves kind of thing. Yeah. So in immersive theater, we have sort of a way of thinking about this in terms of like the level of immersion and how deep into the play that people are going to get. And we call people sunbathers, waiters, swimmers, and divers. So you have some people who are like those divers. They're like, they're in, they're a character. They immediately build relationships. They like network and do all kinds of stuff, right? They're really in it. And then you have like different levels of that. And like up to your sunbathers who are like, I have a cocktail, I'm here, don't talk to me.
Yeah, totally. That's my partner. Yeah.
Yeah.
But somewhere along the way, you're sort of maybe going up to a bartender and be like, so how's the war?
Right.
Sort of like dipping your toe in. Right.
Yeah. And our bartenders are role players as well. So it's like everybody involved is a role player and a LARPer of some stripe, or an actor who's been trained in these types of things. So everyone's fully on board with the play pretend.
Yeah. So thinking about Club Drosselmeyer or Star Cruiser or whatever, like, I'm curious, I'm sure it depends on the experience, right? But like, what are you prioritizing? Like, are you prioritizing artistic expression? Like, is there like a theme or like, you know, a thematic argument or idea that Club Drosselmeyer is like trying to convey? Or is it more just about entertainment, or just that feeling of like being in another time and place, or just profit? Like, what are the various things that you think about as an artist here?
I think it so depends. Like, I'm working on an immersive theater piece right now that is like a huge immersive theater piece that's going to be on stages in London. Mm. And the goals of that piece are wildly artistic. Like, we're going to have people go in and see something they can't unsee, and they'll be changed forever for the better. And like, we'll solve all of humanity's problems with this piece, you know? Like, it ranges from the super high concept, very, very like cerebral, intellectual sort of thing, to the very campy and kitschy, like, I'm here to do something goofy and interact with like a Muppet. Like, so I like, for me, it really depends on like what in particular I'm trying to say with the artistic work, right? So I like to layer in little things, even in pieces that are campy and kitschy. I like to often address a topic or layer in a topic that's something that has a little bit more meaning, something for people to attach to a little more. But that's just my artistic preference.
Yeah. In like a more freeform LARP design, I mean, this could just be me talking to myself about tabletop games, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Like, games are such an interesting medium where, like, I'm also a screenwriter, right? And, like, I know when I'm trying to be an artist and convey my artistic thing in the screenwriting, I know how to do it. And then, like, it's like me monologuing to an audience, right, through the medium of movies. But when I'm being a game designer, I can't do that in the same way, because there's this, it feels like there's a layer between me and that, like the players are gonna have to like
ask, don't tell, like, right?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. It's like it's supposed to be a more open-ended experience, but I'm still trying to convey meaning in it. And I'm curious to hear you talk about, like, especially in these like bigger, larger scale projects, how are you thinking about that? Like, how are you, what means are you conveying meaning by?
So part of it is that you have to train all of your actors to be good GMs. So like, you need to train people the difference between monologuing at them and asking them questions that lead them gently down the road towards where you want to go, right? So some of this is very teachable technique, right? Like, people, like I said, people long for connection. Like, what we really want out of these experiences is connection. And so there are going to be no lack of people or opportunities for that connection to happen. And it's really about, how do you respond in that moment? Like, how do you make sure that you are truly present and engaged and not just waiting for your turn to talk?
Yeah. How are you thinking about it in terms of the environment itself. Do you think of the environment itself like as a tool that you can build in to do that kind of work?
Absolutely, but it depends on the environment. So like some of the my proudest environmental design work has been for LARP mods, right?
Where
we're putting people into a laboratory and they have to explore it and figure out like what the scientists did here and what went wrong and all this other stuff, right?
Sure.
So part of that is like just it's really like level design skill and environmental storytelling skill.
Yeah, totally.
And I think that like tabletop and designing for tabletop can be extraordinarily helpful for like actually doing this same skill set and translating it into a physical reality. Because the first thing I do is I actually draw like a layout of the room that I'm in and I physically block out where I want my characters to be, where I want my different things to be. I want to make sure that I have a plan so that when people go into the room, I'm going to know what their sight lines are. I'm going to know what they're looking at. I'm going to know where their attention is drawn. So it's that same thing that you do as a GM when you verbally tell people like, oh, you made a great perception check. Here's what you notice. Except you're doing that with lighting and sound and like just making sure that those things are going to come to the forefront in a way that's more physicalized.
That's so interesting. Yeah, going back to being a filmmaker, I'm thinking about being a director and how much the job of being a director is just like trying to point, like trying to make the audience look at the right place. Just like being aware of where the audience is looking and directing their attention.
Totally.
That, and like my partner's a theater director too, and it does feel a lot like in that medium, you're directing attention to the right place. And I love that comparison to a perception check that you're, whether it's verbally or with lighting or sound or color or whatever, it's about directing attention.
Exactly. Like I said, I think there's a lot. These mediums translate really, really quite fluidly.
Is there something that I haven't asked you about yet that you feel like is a particularly like transferable skill here?
Yeah. Okay. So I think this is something that people underestimate in their tabletop games, that they don't think about their lighting and sound design. And
I really
holy
wanted to get into this.
You can really, really make things much more epic and much more immersive with just a little bit of sound design and a little bit of lighting changes, right? Just like changing the lighting and then having a little control over your lighting so that you can like change everything to a red light at the like optimal moment. Like, oh, players will go nuts. Like it's so much fun. And these are easy ways to do these things too that are fairly cheap. Like it's not expensive to get a color changing light bulb in this day and age that connects to your phone app or whatever, you know?
You can buy them at IKEA. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really interesting. I think about how big the oohs and ahs are at the D&D table whenever the DM puts down a map. Like, it's just like, here's one little object that exists in the real world and in the fiction, and isn't that neat?
I'm a huge fan of minis. I also like to, like, prepare meals for my players that are, like, on theme in the
world. I was
going to
bring that up, too.
You know, like,
yeah.
And a lot of my players will come to, like, sort of, like, semi-cosplaying as their characters, right? Like, they'll have little elements of their characters that they like to wear to get into it. And I think that's so awesome and so fun. I love to encourage it.
My friend showed up to Big Bad Con this past year with just a little backpack full of, like, hats and scarves for people. And,
amazing.
Like, every game that he played, it was just like, this hat seems like it'd be good for you. And, like, it didn't matter if it was a LARP or a tabletop thing. Out came the hats, you know?
That's
and, like,
awesome. That's
it
awesome.
Was a nice little addition.
That's so cute.
Yeah.
That's really cute.
Yeah. I think there's a way to take it like a little step further too, because we're talking about conveying mood through like one extra sense in a way, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like whether that's it's a cool map instead of a sketch, or whether that's we're going to control the lighting to match the thing, or I'm going to pull out Pocket Bard and like set the score or whatever.
Or I'm going to use real coins like as currency.
Yeah.
We're going to track our currency because we're going to have real coins that you have to like hold in a little pouch.
And once your bag is full, you can't carry any more out of the dungeon.
You're encumbered, you know, sorry.
Yeah. God, that's the best encumbrance mechanic I've ever heard of. But that actually is like pushing towards the thing I was going to say next, which is one of the most memorable D&D sessions I've ever played was when we showed up at a town and there was a traveling theater there and the DM handed out play scripts and was like, you've been cast in the play. And suddenly like we had a real script to do the thing. And it became, I mean, like, I did a whole long episode about maps, and the Fall of Magic map in particular is so good at sort of getting people, and like the beauty there of, I said this already, but an object that exists in reality and in the fictional fantasy world.
Yeah.
But I think when that object is then like really used in the story, it like really brings you in to the moment.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the beauty of it is that if you have this physical object, then all of these stories and all of these memories are tied to this object, and you can keep it and put it on your little shelf and like always have that to remind you. And I think that's so beautiful because our art forms are ephemeral. So very often they're just not really captured. So being able to have like a little token that you can bring with you is really special.
Yeah, that keepsake game term from Xing.
Yeah, I think that like it's easy to underestimate the power of like physicalizing things.
Yeah.
It's easy to forget that we have five senses and that we can use all of them in our gaming experiences.
Mm.
So anytime that I'm seeing somebody like bring those things into it in a new way, it's really, really cool. Like, I've also seen just people play with physical space in ways that are like just unique and surprising, right? Like the incorporation of like water, like everyone's got a cup of water and you have to pour these things in order to solve a puzzle. Like, ooh, wow, fun, you know, like that's exciting. Or you have like liquids that are color changing when you mix acids and bases together. Like, you know, we haven't done that since we were kids in chemistry classes. And like, it's just so delightful to like bring it back and like remember.
And now we get some gold out of it.
Yeah.
Something I'm sort of reflecting on as you're talking about this is how much the kind of thing that we were talking about feels like it is designing for like one specific moment, right? Mm-hmm. Like those play scripts that I mentioned or the water puzzle that you're talking about here is like, yes, something awesome that you can do at like your home D&D group today. And also, can you make a whole game out of like, you, I guess you can make a whole game out of those kinds of things, but it,
totally.
But it also feels like you get a lot of mileage out of the way those play scripts were written like for me and my friends. Like and that tailoring of experience to your audience feels really powerful.
Absolutely. I think that like the, because it is sort of really showing someone that you've thought about them conscientiously and that you really care about their experience, like they feel that connection from you, you know, and that's really, really cool. And I think that even in games that are like repeatable things that where it's not necessarily designed or tailor made for you, there's still like the other players around the table and there's still your GM who are like, you know, putting this on for you. So it's always going to be a unique experience. It's always going to be in the moment.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I'm curious to just hear you like, do you have like a favorite LARP story that you can tell me?
Oh my God. I think that my favorite LARP story is probably my first LARP story. And it's because of this was the experience that like set me on this path because it was so cool. So I was 18 the first time I heard about LARPing. I did not know it existed. I grew up in a very small town in Connecticut. And me and my friends did a whole bunch of other nerdy stuff, but LARPing was not something that was known to us. So some friends went away, they learned about LARPing at a Boy Scout retreat, they came back, and we all decided to go to this LARP together. So we all made our costumes, we made our weapons, we made everything ourselves, like with, you know, duct tape and pipe foam. We show up at this LARP, and we had been like really talking a big game because we were 18. So we're like, we're coming in, we're like the coolest guys who ever lived. And so the GMs were like, let's fuck with these kids. This is going to be fun. In a fun way, not in like a like a mean way. So they had set up this plot line where there was like a necromancer who was going to be like harassing the town. And he was going to like pull our group in and menace and just like menace everybody and run a terrifying scene and like kill them all and like turn them into undead. So I had been having such a good time at this LARP. I was meeting all these new people and like having all these fun new experiences, everything. I was playing this like really like sexy elven ranger who was like dressed very sexily, because I was like, well, why not? And so I missed this mod entirely. I had no idea that it had taken place. My friends were just gone, and I was like, where'd they go? Anyway, they came back to the tavern, and then they were like, hey, we have to tell you something really important. They took me out into the woods and killed me and turned me into one of these undead as well. So there were no rules for how necromancy worked. So what they told me was what the GMs told them, which is that anyone that you kill, you can turn into undead. Like, you can just tell them that they're undead now too. And yeah, like, that's how that's going to work. And I was like, so did you just make me a necromancer? Do I have this power now? Okay, interesting, interesting. So the GMs had no idea that I had been turned into a necromancer. So game goes on, everything. My friends all have a mod that's run for them where they get turned back and they're no longer undead. And like that little thing ties up neatly. But I had a plan. So I realized that there is a very OP game system where a thief could waylay somebody, and if they waylay you, you are just knocked out. There's no recourse for that. And once you're knocked out, anyone can slit your throat. You're like, you're just dead. So I was like, I can definitely take out at least one thief by myself.
Yeah.
So I did this. So I tricked one of the thief players into coming into a remote place in the woods with me, attacked him, killed him, turned him into an undead. And then I was like, here's the deal. We're going to take over the town. And he was like, great. So we went around, and my plan was to use my 18-year-old feminine wiles to get all the fighters in the town to be distracted while he would sneak up behind them, waylay them, and then we would murder them. And this worked so well.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah.
And so by the time that the game staff realized what was going on, we had killed more than half of the town, and like everybody was an undead servant. And so rather than punishing us and being like, what the fuck were you kids doing? They were like, this is awesome. This is so cool. So they turned all the NPCs into townspeople to fight us. And then they like, you know, took back over. But then they had the necromancer was like really impressed with my work. And then that started like this whole plot line of this like necromancer seduction plot thing. It was so fun. And yeah.
It sounds like there's a great lesson in there about saying yes.
Totally. 100%. And like not punishing for not totally understanding a rule. And like looking for the joy in like what these players are doing isn't harming anyone. They're creating like a playful space for everybody. So there's no point in punishing them. So let's like invite them in a little more. And I think that's such a really good lesson for like people to take.
That's such like the fun of emergent play to me, right? It's to see what the fuck weird thing that no one could have predicted happens.
Exactly. Yeah.
I also see something interesting in there about communication in LARP, especially over like a large group. That's just like something you don't have to think about when your table is five people, right?
Yeah.
But like how, I mean, I know the term fog of LARP, which I think refers to this thing. How do you manage fog of LARP? How do you manage communication?
I combat this with a three-pronged information system at all times. So there's going to be three different sources of telling you the same thing so that players believe it. Because the first NPC, they're going to be like, we don't trust them. The second NPC, they're going to be like, we don't trust them. The third NPC, they're going to be like, well, the three people are telling us the same thing now. It's probably true. And, you know, Diaspora A is only going to hear it from one person. Diaspora B is going to, you know, so you need to, like, hedge your bets and try to give them the information three different ways.
Yeah. I mean, three clue rule out of tabletop mystery design, right?
Exactly.
Like, give people three clues for every step of the mystery.
Rule of three for everything, man.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, how do you think about, on the one hand, I'm like, okay, if you're the GM in that story you just told, how do you think about like managing who knows what and what's going on and responding? And on the other hand, it feels like the answer to that question is just like, that rules and that's your job. You just like figure it out, you go. But I don't know. I'm curious to hear you talk about what it's like to be in that position, if you can imagine that, or if you've been in that.
So it's helpful to have somebody who is essentially your story producer, whether that's like the head GM or whatever it is, but somebody who's going to like do a continuity check and be like,
sure,
this is bananas and no.
Yeah.
You know, somebody needs to say no. Like, because otherwise you're going to end up with like really different lore depending on the writers and like what's going on. So making sure that you have somebody who is going to sort of like lore check and make sure that that is going to work, I think is important. And then I think the rest of it is like really trusting your team, trusting your writers, like, you know, knowing and believing that they are going to have like really cool ideas, and that if you're the head GM, then your job is really to support your team and like make them shine and put them in positions to succeed is the best thing you can do. So like work with people you trust, work with people whose story ideas you admire, and and keep those relationships strong because they're fundamental to your game being successful.
Yeah. Okay. I need to start wrapping up here, but also I feel like that this is frankly why I like to have a very specific topic to cover, because I feel like there's a hundred more things I could ask.
30 hours and never get to the bottom of it. Yeah.
Well, and like I would need to go do like 6 years of weekly LARPing in order to like ask you some of the questions that I want to be able to ask you about, right? But I do want to be able to like sign off here with, do you have any final things that I haven't asked you about that you want to make sure to mention, or anything else that you want to be able to say about LARP design and the design of like larger forum experiences at large?
Yeah, I think that where we're sort of struggling as a community right now is figuring out how do we scale, but sort of keep our integrity as storytellers.
Sure.
And that's a really, really hard problem. But I do think that this is a problem that has solutions. Like, so an idea I want to put forward is like tabletop is a perfect model for this, right? Where if you look at tabletop groups, you generally have like a 1-to-5 ratio of sort of GMs to players. Mm-hmm. And I think that this is true in a lot of storytelling formats, and LARP being no exception here. So I think that if we can figure out ways to sort of like activate those GM type players and allow them to exist within the world, but also like be creating their own story worlds, I think that we're heading in the right direction then. So if our job is to create immersive worlds and then empower people to tell stories within them, that's how I think we can start to solve some of these scalability issues.
Yeah. When you're talking about scalability, are you talking about like sustainability, like up to 1,000 people? Like what, when you say scalability, what do you mean?
I'm talking like theme park throughput, like that level of like people participating in a LARP or, you know, going to a role-playing theme park, which I think is in the future.
Oh,
I know, right?
Sounds amazing. Yeah, you're gonna enlist me for my free labor GMing for all my friends when I come to the theme park. But
It's one of those. If you're a storytelling type, you can't turn it off. Like,
You know. I mean, that's the fun part for me. Right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Cool. Well, Caro, thank you so much for coming on.
My pleasure. It was such a delight to talk with you, Sam.
Yeah. Thanks again to Caro for being here. You can find more of them on their website, caro-murphy.com, or at various links in the show notes. Thanks to everyone who supports Dice Exploder on Patreon. As always, you can find me on Blue Sky at Dice Exploder or on the Dice Exploder Discord. And my games are at sdunawall.itch.io. Our logo was designed by Sporgery. Our theme song is Sunset Bridge by Purely Gray. And our ad music is Lily Pads by my boy, Travis Tesmer. And thanks to you for listening. I will see you next time.